Every night, beloved listeners, Helena Katz-Chernin's music introduces Late Night Live, and you hear the voice of Jane Sheldon. Now, tonight, I'll be heading off into the darkness. I'll be driving for at least 4 hours until I get to the farm, and on this occasion, Jane Sheldon's coming with me because I've just walked in and found I've got a prezzo. It's called Nature, and it's a collaboration between Jane Sheldon, who these days is based in New York, and a pianist, Nicole Panizza, who's based in the UK. And it's what it sounds fantastic. It's settings of New World poets by New World composers. You've got Aaron Copland, Nigel Butterley, Ross Edwards, Peggy Glanville Hicks, and words by Emily Dixon, Wallace Stevens, Walt Whitman, and Judith Wright. So I will be a very happy motorist this evening. In a minute, someone who's not at all happy, Patrick McGorry, we're going to be talking about the government's crackdown on youth mental illness. We'll be meeting a young Australian documentary maker who's made a terrific film on an old friend of the program, Gore Vidal. And then Babette Smith has written a scorchingly interesting book on the Irish in Australia, on Irish convicts. But first of all, let's look at this shake-up and more of an earthquake involving Australia's $100 billion welfare system. It includes shifting more people with mental illness off the disability support pension into work. Now, currently, 830,000 people receive the DSP, but the persistent problem remains the stigma surrounding mental illness and the unwillingness of employers to hire them. Now, the interim report on the welfare system has, as I said, singled out young Australians with a mental illness. And Professor Patrick McGorry, who you'll all recall was an Australian of the Year, joins me. He's Executive Director of Origin Youth Health, which is an internationally renowned youth mental health organisation. And Patrick is also Director of Headspace and Professor of Youth Mental Health at the University of Melbourne. Welcome, Patrick, to our little wireless program.
Thank you, Philip.
I was a bit nonplussed by Jeff Kennett's utterance this week. Jeff, of course, chairman of Beyond Blue, said that having a mental illness should not be an automatic entry into a lifetime of welfare. Well, I suppose that's fair comment thus far.
Yeah, I think it is fair comment thus far, and we agree to it up to a point, because the young people that we see, the last thing we want to see happen to them with emerging mental health problems is to end up on the DSP. It's a scrap heap, and it's a passport to marginalisation and poverty in many cases. So it's not a great outcome. But on the other hand, if you want to prevent that, you've got to invest to ensure that that isn't the outcome. And we do have really great evidence now from the IPS model, which was originally developed in the US and has been focused much more on the early stages of illness in Melbourne through research from Owen Kalacki and colleagues who work with us. And we're really very confident we can actually reduce the risks of ending up on the DSP for a very large number of young people.
Now, Patrick, the stats show that 27% of young Australians are diagnosed with mental ill health, 27%. And half of that figure are moderate to severe cases. In your experience, how much do kids with mental illness still want to work?
Well, Owen and his colleagues have looked at this very carefully, and the vast majority of them do want to work. So I think a punitive approach is not the way to go. And I think I was listening to Kevin Andrews on 7:30 Report the other night, and he seemed to be very clearly acknowledging that it wasn't a question of, and I hope that I really hope that this is reflected in what they actually do. He seemed to be acknowledging that some people do need that kind of support, and there's probably a substantial number of people that do. And I think we've got to draw a distinction too between the people who are at risk of ending up on the DSP in that way and those who really do need it and who have been ill for many years. And the chances of getting people off the DSP once they've been receiving it and are clearly disabled for a number of years diminishes, but even there it's not zero. So the government has a case, but how they actually prosecute it is the key. And coming back to Jeff Kennett, he did highlight the issue and opened the door, but the key thing he needs to sort of, I think, acknowledge is that you've got to invest to ensure that those better outcomes do occur.
Outgoing Disability Commissioner Graham Innes said, and I quote, "We don't need a welfare plan which moves the goalposts for people with disabilities. What's needed is a jobs plan which moves people with disabilities off welfare and into work." And he did add, and once again, I don't think either of us would disagree, no government has yet done that properly.
No, but I actually did appear before the McClure Inquiry, and I will have a chance to go back again to present the results of this research that we've done. And I found them very receptive, and I think the Minister too is receptive. So I think there's still some hope that from at least the emerging mental illness point of view, we might get some positive steps taken. But then I think there's a lot of anxiety amongst people who have been on the DSP for many years and who really aren't very optimistic about the prospects of working, and objectively they are disabled. So I think some reassurance for those people is necessary at this stage.
There's been, tell us more about IPS, individual placement and support. Mm-hmm. This fascinates me.
Well, this was originally developed in patients with severe and enduring mental illness, and to everyone's surprise, once you start to do some fairly simple things like basically try to find out what they wanted to do, what type of work they were interested in doing, and then help them prepare for it and actually work with new employers and I guess once they got into a job, support them on the job, the recovery rates were actually not too bad, like 30-40%. And this was in the most severely disabled group of patients. So we then applied that to young people with potentially serious illnesses like schizophrenia at the outset of their illnesses, and we found that we had a massive rise in return to work and education from about 40 or 50% up to about 90% in two major trials that we've done.
But Patrick, that's terrific.
Yeah, so I think there is a good news story buried in all this this concern, as long as the government is committed to invest some new funding to make that happen. And we've written what we call a white paper, and we have given this to government and to the inquiry to suggest some things they can actually do to turn this around. And they will still save heaps of money, actually, both from reduced welfare payments proactively in this way, and also people will be paying taxes. So it's actually a highly cost-effective thing to do, but if you just cut the welfare benefits without doing this, it'll be very, very disastrous.
There's also, is there not an ongoing need to educate prospective employers into not being so panic-stricken at the thought of mental illness?
Yeah, well, they probably already know that 20% of their workforce already has mental illness. In any workplace, there's about 20%, as I think Jeff Kenner's actually and Beyond Blue have been working on, who do suffer from mental ill health. So I think that is the other side of the coin, and Jeff did comment on this today, that we do need to work with employers and create the right environment in the workplace for people to return to. So that's part of the IPS model. It's not exactly rocket science. It's sort of preparing people for a return to work. It's putting them in place. It's negotiating with the employers. It's dealing with any stresses and strains that might occur in the transition and making sure they can stay in the job. And I think the research data is really, really strong.
We've also got to remind the listener that when we talk about youth mental illness, we're addressing the fact that about 75% of mental disorders will have developed by the age of 25.
Well, that's the key point. And I think if we want to improve not just humane and personal outcomes in for mental illness and mental ill health, it's an economic imperative as well. The World Economic Forum produced a report a year or two ago showing that alongside cardiovascular disease, mental illness is the greatest threat to GDP over the next 20 years. So $16 trillion worldwide will be eroded from GDP because of the failure to address mental ill health. And so it's actually a key issue. And the reason for that is because of what you said, that the main sort of surge of new cases occurs in the teenage, young adult period, just when people should be becoming productive and embarking on the next key phase of their lives, and they are affected by mental ill health. Physical illness affects people at the other end of life, and therefore it's not so economically important, even though obviously it's a humane issue all the same.
Now, Patrick, I understand that you're instrumental in ABC's Mental Health Week, which will take place in October, when we'll have some special programming right across radio, television, online.
Well, this is wearing another hat as the president of what has been the Australian Society for Psychiatric Research, and we put a proposition to the ABC late last year to actually conduct a national telethon and a national program around mental health, modelled on what has happened in other countries in medical research generally. And to our surprise, the ABC jumped at it, and I've got to acknowledge Andrew Denton here, who really helped us with this. But Mark Scott and the whole management of the ABC, I think, you know, they had tremendous vision in seeing how this was a national contribution they could make. And so it's all systems go, as far as I can see, with all platforms of the ABC engaged in this. And it's going to be launched soon. I'm not sure if we're jumping the gun here, but it's a fabulous thing. And the main thing is that it will be a huge national anti-stigma campaign, which will improve attitudes and awareness and hopefully government support. And I do think, even though that the coalition's probably in the firing line at the moment for some of these changes, they have been pretty committed to mental health, and they actually feel proud of what they've done. So we're hoping that the bipartisan support for mental health care can keep improving.
I'm going to give you a koala stamp, Patrick McGorry. Thank you. Patrick is Professor of Youth Mental Health at the University of Melbourne and, yes, former Australian of the Year. We should get them all together, all the living former Australians of the Year. They'd be a very powerful pressure group. Thanks for your time, Patrick. Coming up, Gore Vidal, the United States of Amnesia. One of my great pleasures on the Little Wireless program over the years has been to chat with the late, great Gore Vidal, hearing him speak without fear or favour about war, empire, religion, sex, and the United States. We also, of course, had frequent contributions from his once-anointed Dauphin in Christopher Hitchens. And it was very sad when the two of them fell out. All of memories came rushing back when I was looking at this remarkably good doco on Vidal, Gore Vidal, the United States of Amnesia. And I think it's great that it's been made, because I guess there's an awful lot of younger people who know bugger all about the acerbic novelist and commentator, Mr. Vidal. The director happens to be an Australian, Nicholas Rothel, and he joins me now to talk about what it must have been like to spend time with one of the more intriguing figures of our age. Nicholas, welcome to Late Night Live, and well done.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, Gore, of course, had a passing interest in Australia. I think it was on this very program that he met Bob Carr, for example.
Yes.
But he also had a bit of an interest in Whitlam, didn't he?
He did. You know, I think he considered Bob Carr a bit of a friend, and he'd met Whitlam a few times, and Margaret too, I think, and I think Gough had actually visited him in Ravello.
They were rather alike in many ways, Gough and Gore.
Yeah, I mean, I've never met Gough, but I can see, you know, the comparison. They're both sort of, I guess the old-worldly figures of the left, and, you know, I like to think that Gore was sort of in conversation with Gough and maybe even a bit of a mentor to some people on the left. And I know he spoke to Bob Carr regularly.
Yeah. Well, I remember Bob being on the program with Gore and coming off air and saying it was one of the most wonderful occasions of his life. What drew you to Vidal? Was it, I suppose, you would have enjoyed his spirited response to the Middle Eastern interventions of the United States of Amnesia?
Well, exactly. That was exactly what drew me to him. I was living in New York for a long time in the 90s, and Gore was very outspoken after 9/11. I was there during 9/11, and he seemed to be one of the only voices of reason in the American media landscape at the time, speaking out against the rush to war and you know, inevitable Bush administration's kind of knee-jerk reaction to the tragedies of the Twin Towers. And, you know, I'd known about Gore for years and read some of his work, but he really sort of grabbed me at that time, and I'm a younger generation, and I started rereading a lot of his essays. And
we're allegedly living through a golden age of television, but for my generation, there was another golden age, and it was when Vidal, Chayefsky, Et al., were writing live-to-air television dramas that were going out, which were absolutely electrifying, and which had the knock-on effect of reviving Hollywood, because so many of these sort of live plays went on to become remarkably powerful feature films.
Yeah, well, I think Gore spent a long time. I think it's something a lot of people don't know so much about Gore, is that he spent a lot of time in Hollywood in the 50s writing those teleplays, as he called them. And, you know, that sort of led him into writing films. And that was before he wrote The Best Man and some of his plays as well. And I think he really sort of honed his writing craft in terms of dialogue and the televised material. And at that time, it was a really productive time. He was working on the lot and just writing with a team constantly for years.
I remember Gore Vidal vividly in the prime of life, when he was in just an endless ball of energy. What you've got are images of him towards the end of his life, when he's overwhelmed by frailty. I've heard the stories before. I know them well. Mm. But I haven't heard him tell them with such resonance. Here's a guy looking straight down the barrel of death, and it makes him reconsider and rethink and reevaluate almost everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was lucky to catch him, you know, at that point when he was sort of quite melancholy in a way. His partner Howard had passed away, and he was reflecting, I think, on the state of America, which is what he did throughout his life. But he was really sort of quite pissed off by the Bush administration, and really motivated to sort of get out his final words, I think. And really, it was excited to have me sort of trailing him around and getting his message out for the final time. I think he was fully aware that he was coming to an end.
As was Christopher Hitchens, because you're filming Christopher when he had weeks really left to live. And so there's a... Anyway, look, there's one of the great zinger lines in the doco. I never heard a patriotic word said by an American soldier about anything. Let's just have a listen to it out of the film.
You can persuade people that to go to war and fight for democracy and die leaving a widow and orphan children behind, that this is serving the greater good. Well, it isn't. It's surrendering to everything evil in the society. But they've been persuaded, oh, it's a noble thing to give your life for your country. Fuck that. I spent 3 years in World War II, the good war. In 3 years in the Pacific, mostly north, but a little bit south, I never heard one patriotic word said by an American soldier about anything.
I find that a very useful observation at the moment, when there's so much, well, political theatricality around war. I'm persuaded of the view that very few soldiers are enthusiasts for the project.
But we're told they are. I think you're absolutely right, and you see it a lot of the time. You know, in these sort of YouTube videos and things of soldiers in Iraq on the front line, just how young and how sort of confused they are, or how hyped up they are, but they don't really know what they're getting into. And I think, you know, Gore was a long time pacifist and kind of inherited that from his grandfather in a sense, and as he did many things in his sort of politics and his ethics.
Well, you tell the family history very, very well. And incidentally, I am astonished by the amount of material that you've been able to access. You know, there's tons of stuff with all the combatants, his relationships with Mailer, with
William F. Buckley, the debates. Yeah, I mean, it was an amazing process for me to have access to this enormous amount of television archives. And fascinating to go through all that material.
We expect these days a public figure to have a vast backlog of stuff, you know, bobbing around the net. But you were dealing with someone who was probably the first person to be as well recorded throughout his public life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I know Gore had a long sort of life in public. He was almost the first sort of public intellectual and positioned himself very shrewdly over a long period of time on talk shows, on radio, and really, you know, owned the medium and sort of moved from print to sort of mass media in a sense, at the time that the media was changing so quickly.
At the one point, you show wonderful quotes as well as hearing them. You keep whacking them up as graphics, and this is a paraphrase where Gore says, "Never say no to sex or to the invitation to appear on television." But let's go back to this. Tell the story. He comes from an establishment family, not always wealthy, politically well connected. Grandfather a senator, and like his grandson, a man of towering principles. And the film reveals how incredibly alike they were, how many ideas, ideals they shared.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the key to Gore's character that I discovered, was that, you know, his sort of ethics and his politics and his beliefs and also his courage to speak out really came to him at a young age from his grandfather. He was sort of his grandfather's page as a young man, taking him to the Senate, reading to him. His grandfather was a very famous blind senator and a famous orator. And, you know, he sat at the table with Huey Long and his grandfather and all these politicians in the 30s in America and learnt sort of firsthand what was going on in D.C.
And coming from this sort of political background, he was always personally interested, you know, in political engagement. At high school, we see him as the class politician. He runs twice for the U.S. Senate, and I'd forgotten the second run. Mm. So, but it's almost impossible watching your doco to see him as a career poly, because he really didn't try to make his views particularly palatable, did he?
No, he didn't. He sort of was more of a provocateur. He liked to sort of stir things up, and he'd even say that himself. And he was sort of proud to be, I think, on the edge of politics and coming from the inside of it to be more of a critique than to be directly involved. I think he would have been severely compromised if he'd won office, and we wouldn't have had all the great bon vivants that we have if he'd been in power.
Not only was he decades ahead of his time in confronting the absolute, well, the bedrock, the horror, the real horror of American presidential politics, but of course he was openly gay from a very early time, when this was unprecedented.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he wrote The City and the Pillar in 1948 and sort of outed himself, wrote this openly gay novel.
And he's what? He's about 20, isn't he?
He was 23 years old. Right. He received a lot of resistance. The New York Times banned his books.
We're going to make this point. As a result of that book, he was not reviewed for years by the most powerful and influential newspaper in the country. He was targeted with that ferocity.
Absolutely. I think he always wore that on his sleeve and was always very proud in a time when most people were very closeted. And strangely, that sort of moment when the New York Times did sort of blacklist him is what pushed him out to Hollywood, and that's when he started writing all those teleplays and got involved in sort of theatrical writing. And so I think it was a turning point in his life, and he even comments in the film that he decided right then that he was going to work and make money in Hollywood, and then he could write anything he wanted after he'd sort of established himself.
He was an admirer of Jack Kennedy as a person, but disillusioned with him as a president because of, well, lots of things, Bay of Pigs, Vietnam. And he doesn't take the view that Kennedy would have extracted the U.S. from Vietnam. He thinks that's a piece of mythology. But he says in the film that Kennedy is a reminder to him not to be taken in by someone's charm, and he wasn't. And one of the strongest moments in your film comes towards the end when he's watching Barack Obama's victory speech. Now let's listen to what Gore has to say.
I would like to think of him as completely virtuous. I suspect he's not. Why do I suspect that? Because I know how politics works. If you need $10 million, more than what you've already raised to become the next president, you're going to get $10 million. And heaven knows what you're going to give away. Nothing as gross as Dr. Cheney's Halliburton, but they'd get something out of it. So they made up to him. Well, that just didn't happen because people liked the cut of his jib. It was not his jib that got them. Americans are farcical when faced with force majeure and money, two things that they worship. You can't expect a democracy from a society like this.
Yes, well, he goes further in his denunciation of his of country he loves than almost anyone I can think of.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you pointed that out because some people say, that, you know, claim that he didn't love the country, but he deeply did. And I think he was just so frustrated with the direction it had taken over his lifetime, and especially lately under the Bush administration. And then that moment, I was there with him at the Obama election, and there was so much hope in the air in the country in general. But he, some would say, took a cynical view, but really, from his point of view, a very realistic...
No, a skeptical view.
A skeptical view.
Not cynical. I don't think he was ever cynical.
No, I don't think he was cynical either, but people accuse him of that. And I think you're right. He was just skeptical that one man in that office of president really couldn't change anything and had to answer to the people that had got him there.
As I said, both Hitchens and Vidal often appeared on the program, and I have, I was very fond of Christopher, but we fell out, like almost everyone fell out with Christopher, over Iraq. It was the end of the very strong friendship between Vidal and Hitchens. In your conversations with him, did he regret that?
Did Hitchens regret it?
No, did Vidal regret that?
No, he had no regrets about that. And I, you know, when I interviewed Hitchens, he kept coming back to ask me, you know, why wasn't Gore in touch with him and would he respond to this and would he see this interview? And he really wanted some kind of final conversation with Gore, or at least to have it out with him. And when I saw Gore and told him about the interview, he just shook his head and he had cut him off. He decided long before, when Hitchens made that right turn in support of the Iraq War, Gore just cut him off. He really saw him as a traitor to the cause and he had nothing more to do with him.
There are times when words are unnecessary, when all you have to do is look at that face. I can't think of a more marmoreal and astonishing face. It's, you know, it's not Mount Rushmore, it's anything but that. But it's so ravaged with time and age and illness and experience, a depth of perception.
Yeah, it's... I have a lot of close-ups in the film of Gore's face, and he's very old, and it's sort of warts and all, a lot of those moments with him. And I think, you know, but the gravitas of that man sitting there and speaking to the lens and speaking to us, it's sort of a warning going forward, I think. He really felt like he had to sort of get his word out, get this warning out. And I hope it's a sort of call to arms in a way. And what you mentioned earlier about young people, I hope they discover the film because I think there's a lot of moments in the film that seem very timely even now and prescient.
Were there any topics off limits?
Well, the only thing that Gore wouldn't really answer to on camera was his personal life. He wouldn't speak much about it at all. And, you know, it wasn't my main priority. I wanted the film to be focused on his politics, really. But I would have loved him to speak a little bit more about his relationship with Howard and, you know, what went on and what his personal life was really like. But he liked to keep that very personal. That was his choice.
And yet, you know, there's tons in the film about his loves, the great loves of his life, and he doesn't deny at any point the nature of sexual relationships. But I'm glad that you didn't sort of obsess over that, because it's not the issue. To me, the issue very often is that we're seeing a time when public intellectuals could dominate American television. There he is having these brawls with Buckley, William F. Buckley Jr., the very famous encounters with Norman Mailer, and the masses of American, well, not the masses, but a huge number, are actually watching these conflicts. Wouldn't happen now.
No, you're right. I mean, those were prime time talk shows. He was on the Dick Cavett Show, the Johnny Carson Show, and, you know, his very acidic jokes about Reagan and so forth, and those debates, you know, the 1968 debates with William F. Buckley were huge moments in television at the time. Two patriarchs, one from the right and one from the left, going out.
Both aristocratic.
Both
in
aristocratic,
style,
yeah. Both very eloquent and both very witty and sort of able to stand toe-to-toe with each other and really go for it.
Did they secretly quite like each other?
Not at all.
Wasn't one of those?
No, it wasn't at all. I know there was a sort of litigation threats after that event when Gore calls Buckley a crypto-Nazi, and then Buckley responds by calling him a queer on national television in 1968. And they almost litigated, and there was there was never any reconciliation. They were not friends.
But, of course, he had such a wide circle of friends. There's Paul Newman, Tennessee Williams, Tim Robbins. You know, there's a long list of people, young people too.
All kinds of people used to go and visit him. And, you know, I was really surprised that going through the interviews and the research on who he knew, and it seemed that he knew everyone everywhere.
And a very retentive memory. He could remember quite extraordinary facts about them.
Absolutely. He could remember, it seemed like, everything, the conversations he'd had 20 years before. If you'd bring up someone, he'd refer to a conversation he'd had with them and tell you in detail what they'd said and where they'd been. And it was remarkable. And, you know, I think he really loved people and really loved conversation. And that was his life, really.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there is an affection for people that you see. Even when he's doing book signings, There's a cordiality about him. It's not a chore. He interacts with warmth and friendship.
Absolutely, and I found that too. And I think a lot of people have the image that he's sort of this prickly, dry wit, you know, and that he's... And of course, he could cut anyone down. He wouldn't suffer fools, but he was a generous, warm person as well.
Well, I hope that one of the things the documentary does is renew interest in the novels, particularly these novels on American political history, the books on the likes of Lincoln. These are very, very contrarian works, but God, they need to be reread.
Yeah, they're amazing. And I would actually recommend people maybe read Burr first, which is a fascinating book about the Founding Fathers and getting inside the characters of these people. And it really reads, it's a real sort of page-turner. You know, it's not something that people sort of think, oh, God, historical novel, that's going to be dry and boring. But they aren't at all. They're quite exciting to read.
Okay, he died in 2012, and the film was bookended by shots of the plot where he planned to be buried next to his long-term companion, Howard. Why did you choose that way to open and end the film?
Well, it wasn't something we planned for. When I was in D.C. with Gore, I was talking to him about going to one of his old homes or school, and he wanted to go to Rock Creek Cemetery, which is where Howard was died. And then we ended up shooting this sort of almost Shakespearean scene of Gore standing over his own grave, this little soliloquy. And it just was...
All he needed was a skull for a Las Puyori.
Exactly.
Look, it's a great opening and a great ending, but the story of Gore Vidal has no ending. And I'm terribly pleased to have you on the program. Gore Vidal, The United States of Amnesia, limited release screenings in what are called selected cinemas throughout the month. But it will also be shown on ABC One on July the 27th on Sunday Arts Update. And I should point out that Nicholas Rathall has also written and made a terrific doco on boat people. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you.
LNL, and up next, a different sort of boat person, the so-called lucky Irish, the wild Irish convicts coming to Australia. are now some very different boat people. Breaking news, the Hive has run aground on the east coast of New South Wales. It's transporting 250 Irishmen, 29 soldiers, 8 women and 11 children to our splendid penal colony. All on board survive, greatly assisted by local Aboriginal people until they could be transferred to other ships that could take them to Sydney. Independent historian Babette Smith, and she is decidedly independent, heard the story of the Hive running aground when she was pondering the rather sentimentalised subject of the Irish in Australia. And she decided what happened to the prisoners who survived was a story worth telling. And in telling that story, she's explored the Irish convict's contribution to the development of this country. Babette's other books include Cargo of Women, Susanna Watson, The Convicts of the Princess Royal, and Australia's Birthstain, her latest, yes, The Luck of the Irish. And Babette joins me now in the Sydney studio. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Philip. Good to be here.
What happened on the night of the 10th of December in 1835? Take your mind back. The events must be very fresh in
your
memory.
All right. It wasn't a bad night at sea. It wasn't stormy. The wind was blowing, gusty, but, you know, not dangerous. But it was a steadily propelling flotsam and jetsam towards the shore. The main problem on the Hive was that the captain, I think he was drunk, although nobody ever uttered the word drunk, and he'd set a course that he wouldn't let anyone change. The chief officer, Edward Canny, tried to get him to change course. He warned him they were too close in. But the captain had all that obstinacy of somebody who's drunk too much, and he said no. And sure enough, they ran aground.
Now, the interesting thing is why the convicts didn't seize the opportunity the shipwreck created, because they, you know, they could easily have escaped, run off into the bush, made a boat out of the wreckage, and, you know.
That's one of the strange questions of Australian history. Well, it's not strange. When you really investigate it, it's quite logical that they wouldn't want to be anywhere else but Australia. They did desperate things to get there, some of them deliberately. But there's no doubt that the Irish prisoners had the numbers on the beach that day. There were 250 of them, only 29 soldiers.
Yeah.
And I had researched the Irish crimes, and I knew just how bloody and violent that group could be.
Well, as you point out, bloody, brutal, personally inflicted violence was the reality of crimes for which many of them were transported. Yes, they included, you know, the odd pickpocketer or an errand boy who stole sugar, but a lot of them were all too familiar with violence.
That was very unexpected to me. I was deluded, as everybody else, that the Irish were basically helpless innocents who mainly stole sheep. And if they had protested and were being transported for political reasons, that somehow their protest had never involved a fist connecting with a jaw, let alone a stick or a stone.
But you point out that almost the tradition of violence circles around politics, religion, education, sexual relationships.
And tribal violence. That really took me aback, because that was Irish fighting Irish. And there was very vivid description of a massacre on the strand or beach of the was the Cashin River. And one of the men on the Hive had been caught up in that. So obviously I was very interested to come to grips with it in detail. And it made the hair stand up in the back of my neck, actually.
And, of course, they would dine out, this particular group, on the way they'd arrived in Australia for the rest of their lives. It was an adventure.
The shipwreck made them notable. And if you're following them through the records, you can see them bringing up the shipwreck. When they're asked the standard question in the penal colony, and watch, ship did you arrive in? They say the Hive, but then they go on to say how they were shipwrecked.
Well, you've explained to me why they didn't do a runner, when to some extent they could have exercised that option. And they finally get to Sydney. What did they find when they got here?
Well, the first thing they found, which must have pleased many of them, was that there was an Irishman running the colony, and that was Governor Richard Burke. He was from Limerick. Some of the Limerick men would have had personal acquaintance with him. He did sit as a magistrate, but offsetting that, he was also chairman of the Irish Relief Fund.
So they find a society in which their own kind are included in every occupation.
Yes. Yes, there were wealthy Irish, wealthy prisoners walking around Sydney or driving in carriages. There were Irish in the police, farmers, shopkeepers. It was very plain before their eyes that there was an opportunity people here.
And yet the society, to some extent, lacked the hierarchical or the class system that they were used to.
Well, that's one of the issues on which I think we've been really misled by our own ignorance, because what we didn't understand was, firstly, that the gentry were so tiny in numbers, which they exacerbated by just coming here for 10 years, getting rich, and then leaving again. So a lot of numbers that have been recorded as gentry-free settlers doesn't record the fact that some of them departed.
Now, let's look at this Irish governor, because he seems like he wasn't a bad bloke. He was a liberal with quite interestingly calibrated views on issues like education and religion.
He was a great supporter of secular education, which removed
religion.
We need
him now.
Oh, I know.
Bring him back.
Look, he sowed the seeds of the support for secular education that Henry Parkes eventually brought in. But Burke laid the groundwork and created support in the community.
So this is another aspect of Irishness. He didn't want to have the sectarianism that he'd observed back home.
He felt very strongly about that on the grounds of both education and religion. He wanted the Irish to be equal, and he wanted to take religion out of education.
And so all kids would get educated, regardless of their background, in a national or state system.
That's right. And he was a Christian. He wanted the various denominations of Christianity to teach their parishioners religion, but separately from the school.
So how did he manage to get the Church Acts introduced into New South Wales?
He got the numbers on the Executive Council for that. I think it was only one by one vote, whereas for the school system, he lost. He couldn't get the numbers on that. So it was a very political exercise, and some of the conservative officials and landholders voted against him. And some surprising conservative officials and landholders voted with him.
While we've established that he didn't want to see an echo of Irish injustice in this country, he did leave a great legacy to the Catholics, didn't he?
Well, yes, he did, because he succeeded in getting the Church Act through, and the terms of the Church Act were that all denominations would be funded equally to bring out clergymen or priests from home and to help them build churches here. But he did connect the funding to the amount of parishioners they had here, and that set off an awful competition between the churches.
Well, you mean branch stacking.
That's right. Yes. But nevertheless, the people of the colony, and I include Protestants as well as Catholics, the ordinary working people, they supported Burke. They believed in a religious equality. There was a meeting of Catholics in Maitland in 1846 where they're thundering about the importance of preserving equality of religion that the good Governor Burke had left for them. He'd gone by then.
At the end of this program, you're driving back to the Blue Mountains and I'm heading for the Hunter. So I will be driving through Maitland and up to my neck of the woods, where the towns are called Scone and Aberdeen, where the local Scots were incredibly influential. Our homestead was built by a Scottish family. Now, they weren't too fond of the Irish, and yet suddenly the Irish are on offer as labour.
Yes, there was a message sent through to the colonial authorities: please don't send us any more Irish. The gentry of the Hunter don't like them. Nevertheless, the Irish were still sent there, and the landholders, of course, needed their labour. But the Irish and the Catholics didn't leave when they could have done, when they got to ticket of leave status or free.
That's fascinating, isn't it? Once again, they don't do a runner.
No.
Just they as they didn't from the boat.
In Maitland.
Yeah.
That's right. But there was always the alternative of the southwest of New South Wales, which was much more Catholic friendly.
But you make the point that the convicts, prisoners, were no fools, that they could smell their employer's fear.
They could, and they used it. The numbers on the beach, difference between 250 prisoners and 29 soldiers, was replicated throughout the colony, and the prisoners knew they had the numbers. It had been very important in the 1788, the early days of European settlement, and it remained important right through the penal colony, and they used it to... Yeah, but
when you say they used it, they actually went on strike, didn't they?
They did. From time to time. They did. There's the seeds of our working class. I know the Labour Party was formed later in the 19th century, but they had a solid foundation to build on because the convicts, they went on strike, they instituted go slows, there was even some instances of enterprise bargaining.
You're making all this up.
No, I've got the facts to prove it. They even negotiated the Australian weekend.
The Australian weekend, I'm sorry.
Half day Saturday and all day Sunday. And don't ask us to go to church because we want to do our washing.
Babette Smith is my guest. And we're discussing how a shipload of convicts survived the wreck of the hive to make a new life in Australia. And the principal title of the book, that's the subtitle, is The Luck of the Irish. Now, one of the things that could bring work to a standstill was a lack of rations. And by the time the hive had been shipwrecked, wages paid to convicts had been discontinued and they relied on the goodwill of their masters.
Yes, well, that was how it was for a while. The wages were from the earliest days. Then the British authorities, through Commissioner Big, tried to make being transported tougher. So they said no wages. And for a while, there were just these incentives in the system, tea, sugar and tobacco, except the convicts had acquired a taste for all of them. And that's when they would go on strike if their master did not provide these so-called privileges.
Okay, let's wrap this up by talking about the intangible benefits to the Australian character that these Irish prisoners brought here.
Well, first of all, just one point I must make. The penal system just subsumed difference. The authorities lumped everyone who was prisoner together. Catholic, Protestant, black, white, didn't matter where you came from. And that was very important to the Irish, I believe, because they became part of the mainstream. Their religious equality they gained is replicated in our Constitution, Section 116, which was the Daniel O'Connell's Catholic Association. That was one of the principles. There will be no state religion. And the Irish, of course, brought their own wonderful kind of, somebody says, sense of the tragic and the wonderful. And
over the years, I've noticed again and again, we've often talked about it, the extraordinary number of Irish names within the Aboriginal leadership. There would be historically a very high level of intermarriage between Irish and the Indigenous people.
Particularly in New South Wales.
Yeah.
Not down in Tasmania.
No, not down in Tasmania. So, like the poor Scots, the Irish recognised that Australia offered them a chance beyond anything achievable at home.
That's right. And making a parallel with today's boat people, they did anything to get here. And not only the Irish, the English and the Scots too. They stole deliberately to get here. They stowed away their children among the ship's crew. One of the men on the hive had his two sons in the ship's crew. And shortly after, his wife, who'd stolen something, arrived on another ship with the two daughters.
Well, you've done it again. And let me quote from the book. Without the Irish factor, our constitution might well have been far less inclusive. Its endurance is something to celebrate. Recognition that in Australia, the luck of the Irish eventually lost its traditional irony and became simply positive. Thanks, Babette.
Thank you, Phil.
I've been talking to independent historian and, yes, a member of the Independent Scholars Association, Babette Smith, and her latest book, The Luck of the Irish, is published by Allen and Unwin. For more information, you can visit our website on abc.net.au/late-night-live. Now, on our next, a profile of the notorious Koch brothers, and we'll also look at the men behind Australia's problem with obesity. Stick around for now for the news, and I will talk to you again in 23 hours. Babette and I are now heading home.
This week on the Sunday Extra podcast, I ask Professor Joseph Stiglitz whether he's glass half full or glass half empty when it comes to the future of the global economy. He should have a fair idea, Nobel Economics Laureate and all. Discover the state of the Stiglitz glass this week. The markets will be hanging on his answer. Lots else besides. Join me, Jonathan Green. You can stream or download the program from the RN website.